is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads, wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. We've had their partnership manager and training specialist, Jefferson Mason, and marketing manager, Nick Bartlett, on the show in the past, and we couldn't be more excited about what they're doing for the game of basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Beyond efficient reps, Dr. Dish provides training expertise and versatility designed to develop complete players. The new Dr. Dish CT machine has further revolutionized basketball training with over 150 plus on-demand individual and team workouts from some of the best coaches and trainers in the game. These workouts include video instruction and combine game-like shooting drills with ball handling, conditioning, and agility drills. Along with workouts, the Dr. Dish training management system also provides stat tracking and analytics to track progress and ensure accountability. These are just a few reasons why top programs like Duke, North Carolina, Louisville, Florida, Baylor, and countless others are upgrading to Dr. Dish. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com. Follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And make sure you mention the Hoopheads podcast to get $300 off your next Dr. Dish purchase. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get out and get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
You have to be firm in your beliefs, but you also have to be willing to take an honest look in the mirror and realize, you know, okay, just because I thought this was the right thing and I've been planning for this for 2 or 3 years, it doesn't necessarily mean it fits in this exact situation.
Matt Vespa is entering his first year on the Lakeland Community College men's basketball coaching staff and his first year coaching basketball at the collegiate level. Previously, Vespa was the head coach at Kenston High School in the state of Ohio and held an overall record of 44-27 during his 3 years leading the program. During his time at Kenston, Vespa helped guide several players to playing college basketball at Walsh University, Notre Dame College, and Baldwin-Wallace University. Before his time at Kenston, Vespa led the Geneva Eagles for 2 seasons, helping the team set a record for single-season wins in the last 10 years. Prior to his coaching career, Vespa was an all-conference and all-academic player at East Lake North High School in the state of Ohio. After high school, Vespa played at Lake Erie College under Coach Cliff Hunt. Vespa was part of 2 Allegheny Mountain Collegiate Conference championship teams and participated in 2 NCAA Division III national tournaments. Vespa is a USA Basketball certified coach, and he has been featured in basketball clinics internationally. Check out our website, hoopheadspod.com, where you can listen to every episode in our archive. After you've listened to this episode or one of your other favorites, please head over to your favorite podcast app and leave us a 5-star rating and review. Those reviews help others in the basketball community find our show. Make sure you're subscribed to the Hoopheads podcast so you never miss an episode. The pod is available on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Google Play, and YouTube. Get out your notebook right now so you don't miss any of the wisdom shared by Matt Vespa, assistant men's basketball coach at Lakeland Community College in the state of Ohio. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from Lakeland Community College, assistant men's basketball coach Matt Vespa. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks Mike. Thanks Jason. I appreciate it.
Hey, we're excited to have you on, get a chance to talk to you about some of the interesting things you've been able to do in your coaching career thus far and talk a little hoops with you. So let's go back in time to start off and talk about how you got into the game of basketball. When you were a young kid, what made you fall in love with the game?
That's pretty easy for me. It was definitely my dad. He was a basketball junkie. Played basketball in college. They're from Pennsylvania, so he played at University of Pittsburgh, Johnstown. And it was just something he seemed to like it. So I think he liked it. It seemed cool. So I thought I would try it, and I just immediately fell in love with it. I thought it was so cool that you could do it by yourself. You could do it with a group of people. You could do it. You know, if it's raining outside, if it's snowing, you can go inside and do some dribbly drills. And I love the satisfaction of going and working on something and seeing the result. You know, every time you go to the court and, you know, you maybe miss a couple shots, you could go work on it yourself and get back there. And just if you put the time in, to me, it was fair. It was one of the few things in life that was fair, that if you worked hard at it, you would get better. It didn't matter. No one else really had a say in it. Just if it was important to you and you worked hard at it, you got it. So I really enjoy that part.
Yeah, and I think the nice thing about basketball is
there's always a measuring stick. Obviously, there's a lot more to the game than putting the ball through the basket, as we know. But when you're a kid, it's easy to measure your progress with how many times that ball is going through the net.
For sure. Yeah, like you said, I'm not a big math guy or stats guy, but that was something I always like to keep account of and see and just improve. And then you know, I always like the thought of there's somebody else out there that's working harder than me or doing this, or they're getting better and I'm not. And I kind of liked having that in the back of my mind. And just – I think it was the old and one T-shirt. You remember? Not and, no, it was above the rim. Reebok above the rim had the shirt that said somewhere someone's practicing right now and you're not, and when you meet them in competition, you know, they'll beat you. And I remember it was just a cheap T-shirt, but that kind of always stuck with me, and I like that. I like thinking that, you know, sooner or later I'm going to run into somebody and I put in more work than they did and it's going to pay off.
For sure. I think, if I'm not mistaken, we might have to have Jason fact-check us here. I think that quote originally was from Bill Bradley.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken.
I'll do some research.
All right, Jason's going to do some.
Got the crack research
our
team
crack
on.
Research team is going to get on that while we're talking, Matt. Like, so we'll have an answer to that. I'm pretty sure it was Bill Bradley, but who knows?
Nope.
But it's definitely something
No, go ahead.
No, you're good. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's, you know, shows you. Bill Bradley, bring him up. I read his book when I think I was like 10 or 11 years old. I have no idea why. I anything I could get basketball wise, I wanted to know about. I wanted to learn. I thought, you know, having the history of it and being able to see those guys and kind of grow with them and learn and see how the game evolved was just another thing I just kind of fell in love with. So
who's your favorite player growing up?
My dad was a Celtics guy, so I grew up on the Larry Bird household. Still kind of my favorite. He's great. Pistol Pete. You know, my dad actually worked his basketball camp when he was in college. So we grew up, you know, hearing about Pistol Pete. Now I think, you know, nowadays with YouTube, people saw that. But back then, you didn't get to see the clips. You didn't get to see all that little stuff. So we just heard stories about him and all the stuff he did and things like that. So love those older school guys. I think their games still kind of, both of those guys' games would translate well to today's game. So
yeah, I agree. I think I grew up kind of not liking Larry Bird, and I've grown over time to have a lot more respect for him. I think when I was a kid, what I liked was guys who could do things that I couldn't do. And so So I saw Larry Bird. I'm like, man, I should be able to do some of those things. Like he can't really run. He can't really jump. He's just like me. And then I would see a guy like Jordan or Magic Johnson. I'm like, oh, those guys are, you know, different from me. And so I think those were the players that I gravitated towards. And I always hated the Celtics. So just
okay.
for whatever reason. Then as I got older, I've obviously grown to have a tremendous amount of respect for Bird and what he was able to do and just his skill level. And then the Pistol Pete thing, you know, you think back to, I think back to when I was a kid and, you know, he had those, I know he had the one video where he did all his stationary ball handling drills. And, you know, those are things that I grew up, like that was a staple of my life probably from the time I was like 7 years old. I can remember going down to my basement and doing the, you know, the figure eights and the around your back and the drop the ball behind your back and catch it or the bounce between your legs.
Yeah,
and
the quick drill. Yep.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So I was unable to find anything about Bill Bradley trait, like coming from him, but I did find out that he did Deflategate before Tom Brady. There's a good
thing. Oh, there you go.
All right, well, you're going to have to work harder because I'm pretty sure. I'm gonna have to find it after the fact. We might have to just add it in once we find it. I'm pretty sure it's Bill Bradley. But anyway, yeah, it's – I think you go back and you look at Pistol Pete and, you know, you mentioned about being able to see the highlights. And I think that's one of the things that kids today take for granted. Like I go back to when I was a kid and you couldn't see anything. And I mean, there was nothing out there. If you wanted to go and, you know, watch a player and try to learn from a pro guy, what, you know, watch footwork or things. And kids today have such a huge advantage in terms of being able to do that. And then just from an awareness standpoint of historical players, like even the Pistol Pete highlights that are out there, at least the ones that are the most common, you probably see like 10 of them that you see all the time. And if you want to find anything more, you got to dig really deep. And I think Pistol and Wilt are the two guys that I wish there was more film of, so you could see exactly what those guys were when they're in their prime. Because a lot of the Wilt stuff that you see is when he was older with the Lakers. And there's not a lot of highlights from, you know, early 60s Wilt when he was putting up 50 a game. I mean, there are some out there, but most of it's grainy and you can barely see it. And he's a guy that I would have loved to see. And then Pistol Pete, you know, you think about, I don't know, I maybe have seen one or two clips of him when he was at LSU. and, you know, here the guy averaged 44 points a game without, you know, without a three-pointer.
Three-point line. Yeah. Someone went back and did the stats on that. I forget exactly what it is, but someone who had a lot more time than I did went back and watched all his games and kind of mapped out where his shots came from. And if he was shooting these when it didn't even matter that it was a three-point line, he would have averaged, I think it was like 57 a game, they said.
Yeah, I believe it. I believe it. I mean, you hear the stories and you read some of the things about just things that both of those guys, Wilt and Pistol, that their contemporaries said about them, and just, you know, people were just amazed by their ability. But yeah, I think when you're a kid, you know, you have your favorites and you look, and then you try to go out and you try to emulate what those guys do. And I think you made a great point about just being able to measure yourself against something and being able to see and mark your improvement. And for me, one of the things that I always liked about basketball, and I guess I'll ask you in this way, when you were a kid, let's say pre-middle school, pre-junior high, were you spending more time like playing with your buddies in the driveway, or were you spending more time by yourself dribbling the ball in your basement or just shooting on the driveway? Which one would you say was more descriptive of you?
Oh, by myself for sure at that point. I mean, I still, you know, I would play in the city league and things like that and do that stuff, but I was out shooting by myself. It was just, you know, we didn't have cell phones. I mean, I'm 35, but we didn't have a lot of phones. It was, you had to ride a bike to get somewhere and do all this stuff. It was harder. You know, I wasn't playing AU. I wasn't doing any of that stuff. I just, you know, we had a hoop up and I went and shot outside. And on the rare occasion when it was nice and a couple of my friends got together, we'd go play some pickup. But that was it. I think, you know, that's a huge difference now, guys. I don't know how many guys go play outside anymore.
Nobody does is the answer to that.
No. Yeah, you drive by the court and it's not – there's no one there. Every once in a while you'll see someone on a super nice day, but I think that's a huge thing, and I don't want to be the old guy that complains about back in my day, but I think that is definitely a huge difference is guys are way more skilled nowadays. I mean, we both know this. We've worked kids. There's kids that can do stuff that are, you know, 9, 10, 11 years old that I, at my peak, could never do, handling the basketball. I mean, they have more moves than I could, but they have no idea how to actually play the game of basketball. They're trained and they drill and they do that stuff. And it's great, but how does it translate? Where, you know, we would go to the park and we'd play and we'd have to win. And if you didn't win, it might be an hour and a half that you played again. So it was kind of a big deal that you won the game. So you did whatever you had to do.
Yeah, I have said that numerous times on the podcast. And I feel bad for today's kids. And not to say that the system that we have today is bad, because there's positives to it. And you mentioned one of them is that kids are way more skilled. And I think kids get more – there's more kids that get more of an opportunity to play than there used to be. If you think about old outdoor basketball, I know when I was 13, 14 years old, I was probably the only 13 or 14-year-old that was at the parks where I was going to and getting a chance to play, whereas, you know, maybe the other kids my age were playing in their driveway or playing in the neighborhood, but they certainly weren't playing on the same courts that I was playing on. And now you look at it and nobody is playing outside, at least – not anywhere that I've seen. And I think, to your point, it really makes a difference. One, in the fact of how competitive kids are and just learning how to play. I always tell people that when you walk into a gym, you can tell the difference between a kid who's playing basketball and a basketball player.
And, for sure.
And I felt like outdoor pickup basketball helped you develop as a basketball player. Whereas the skill development piece is great, it's a huge part of becoming a better player, but if all you do is skill development and play in games where your mom and dad are sitting in the stands and you have a coach and you have an official, you never really take any risks, you never really try anything new, you never really play against different levels of players where, like, one of the things I loved about pickup basketball is there's times where you're playing and you could be the best player on the court, and now I get to be Mr. Everything. And so I'm handling the ball, and I'm distributing, and I'm scoring, and I can do all this, and I'm kind of the straw that stirs the drink. And then an hour later, some better players show up, and all of a sudden now I'm the 10th best player on the court. And so now I've got to fit into a role, and maybe I've got to play defense, or I've got to grab some rebounds, or I've got to pass the ball and figure out how to get my teammates who are better than me, get them opportunities. And I think that's something that kids just don't get that opportunity. And then the other thing that I always feel sad about is just – for me personally, and I don't know how you feel about this, but for me personally, just that time of being at the court, if I look back on my childhood and early adulthood, those are some of the most cherished memories that I have in my entire life. that I just don't think you can duplicate in an organized basketball setting, because it's not only you're playing ball, but you're also hanging out.
Oh, for sure. I learned more being in those situations from older guys, and probably some words I shouldn't have learned at that point, or some different things, or just from being there. Like you said, I remember in the summer waking up early, riding my bike to the court, stopping and buying one of those big Dairyman's iced teas, and staying there all day, and coming back, and your hands were completely black, you know, that, except not your palms, because the ball never touches your palms, which is a good one. But, you know, you're covering that stuff, and it's, you know, you said it, there's different roles there. I remember, you know, year to year, and we talked about progress and growing earlier, you know, going there when I was 11 or 12 and getting to play with the older guys, and maybe I play for 4 hours and I'd get two or three shots, and I better make those two or three shots. And the next year I go and I'm doing a little bit more, and the next year I'm getting older and older, to the point where I would show up and you know, to me it was a huge deal. They'd be like, oh, Matt's here, he's pretty good, like, we got him, he's on our team, or he's doing that. And just having that respect and kind of climbing that hierarchy, that was phenomenal to me. I mean, some of those moments at the courts rank up there with anything I've done in a high school game or a college game, of just being proud, like leaving and going, man, that was great. And I don't know if guys, I took a couple of our college players to play one day at the park, just messing around, and these guys were really good, and they were by far the best ones there. But they didn't care if they won or lost, and they're not bad guys, and they play hard and they compete hard. But to me, it was they had nothing to prove. I guess they thought I thought every time I went up there, I had something to prove. I needed to. So the next time I showed up, people knew who I was and thought, oh, okay, you know, he's pretty good. So I think it's just a difference in generations, and I'm not sure if one's better than the other, but it's definitely different.
Yeah, it's definitely different. I think if you transplanted us into today's system, there'd be things we'd like, and there'd be things we're like, ugh, man, I don't like this at all. And conversely, you take the kids that, you know, that we have today that are playing high school or college basketball right now, and you put them back into our environment, and they'd say, ooh, you're really going to play outside on cement and beat up your body that way and play.
Yeah, and the one hoop's not even, the one hoop's like 9'9", the other one's, you know.
Right, it's all windy. Like,
so we've talked. Yeah. I've talked a few times in the podcast that most summers we go and we play up at a local, like, development, and they have a hoop that's 9.5 feet, another hoop that's 10 feet, and the 9.5 foot hoop, the rim is bent because obviously people are dunking on that one, and they're not dunking on the 10 foot hoop. But it's also probably the same rim that was there when I was a kid, and they haven't replaced it.
Yeah.
We've broken it a few times and had to put the nuts and bolts, like put new nuts and bolts on it to make it work.
But those are the things that I think are important. You know, we used to play to, you know, 16, you got to switch at 8 because the one rim's bent.
Right,
like,
exactly.
So once it's paired to, like, like, those are little things. But that's, if you're willing to do that, you love playing basketball. You know, you don't need to be inside, oh, it's air conditioning, or it's this, or we didn't need people, at least personally, to say, okay, hey, I need you to make X amount of shots or do this or that. I just, I don't know. To me, there was nothing else I wanted to do. I just wanted to go play basketball all day. So, like I said, I think there's guys now that are way better than we probably were at that age, just because of the coaching and the training, and something as simple as, you know, you can YouTube a move and you're like, hey, how do I do this? Whereas someone would get me with a move and I'd be like, wow, that was pretty cool. I'm going to steal that. Like, that's how we learned things. We couldn't just kind of watch stuff as easily as they do. So, like, there's good and there's bad about both.
Yeah, I like the idea that you could go on, and if I want to emulate something that I see from an NBA player or a college player today, I could do that so easily. And back in our time, you couldn't do that. And you had to learn more by, I think, experimentation, which, you know, again, there's good and bad to both of that. I think by experimentation, you put some things into your game that end up being somewhat unique to you. And yet at the same time, I think by being able to go out and copy some of the people who are the best in the world at what they do, you're going to add something and make it better for your game today. So there's good and bad to both systems. I think the bottom line for me, and you said it right off the top of this conversation, is that kids today are much more skilled. They just are. There's no question that there's more kids who can shoot the ball from three-point range, who can handle the ball really, really well. And you put them in an empty gym against some cones, or just give them a ball and watch them go to work, and they look way, way better. And then conversely, I think guys from our era maybe are not quite as, or weren't quite as skilled as kids are today, but I think there was a greater understanding of the basketball IQ side of it. And so I guess the job for us as coaches then is, how do we bridge, you know, that gap for our current players to help them to develop their IQ and take advantage of those skills that they have. And that'll be a discussion as we move forward into more deeper into the podcast. So let's go back and talk a little bit more about you as a player. Talk a little bit about your high school career. Maybe give us just one or two of your favorite memories from playing high school basketball.
So as a player, I guess if you asked me a couple of years ago, I told you I was really good and I thought I was pretty awesome. I guess the further away I get from it, the more comfortable I am to say that. You know, I was a solid basketball player. I worked hard at it. I played all the time. I could shoot the ball a little bit. And I loved it and I knew what I was doing. So I was an above average player. I would say I was pretty good early on. I had a couple ankle injuries that, you know, held me back a little bit, but all in all, I think for the most part, I kind of reached my potential of being a Division III basketball player. That's kind of where I was supposed to go. As far as memories going, you know, winning a conference championship our senior year was huge. I know that was a big goal for us. And then sophomore year, we got to play. So I went to Eastlake North High School. We got to go to a scrimmage with St. X. And it was a really big deal because Jawad Williams was there. Jawad was going to North Carolina. We were super excited to go and play against a guy like that. And it was couldn't wait. There was another team there, St. Vincent St. Mary's, who had a freshman on there that no one cared about, but his name was LeBron James. And we had no idea who he was. We thought, hey, that kid's pretty good. And a couple years later, we just all laughed about it. We thought, like, and Jawad Williams, and he had a phenomenal career. He's a great player, but he was like the 10th or 11th guy in the Cavs, and LeBron's, you know, the MVP of the league. And we were excited to play him in high school as opposed to that LeBron kid. So it was just kind of funny to have that experience as one of his probably first or second scrimmages. And his cousin Maverick Carter was probably the best player on that team. We thought that was a big deal. But we said he was going to be pretty good.
Was he dunking yet?
Yeah, he was. I mean, he was doing whatever he wanted, basically.
I think that was the scrimmage where actually when we had Flannery on, I think that was the same scrimmage that he talked about where it was the first time that he saw LeBron and then kind of, you know, had him in the back of his mind as things went forward, you know, keeping an eye on him. And then eventually, I know there was the year when they had the Nike Hoop Summit. It was supposed to be just for seniors, and Flannery's like, hey, you know, LeBron should be there. And so he said, that's how I take credit for discovering LeBron. So
he did. I like that. We had no idea. We thought, man, that kid's pretty good. And then our coach said, he's only a freshman. Like, man, he's going to be, he'll probably go play in college somewhere. And
right, then, exactly. You know? Yep.
So yeah, those were kind of, I would say the keys, you know, the big ones for me. And then going on to college at Lake Erie College, we get part of a really, really good, like I said, I belonged at a Division III level, which is still really good basketball. That's not, you know, to put it down at all. But we had a bunch of guys that didn't belong there that were probably Division I or Division II players. So we were pretty successful. We were able to win two conference championships. I think we finished 28-3 the one year. Made it to the Sweet 16, lost to John Carroll on a last-second shot to go to the Elite Eight. So I had a really, really fun college career. Learned a ton from Cliff Hunt, who was a coach at the time. But I think it was one of those things where, like I said, I recently realized I reached my max potential as a basketball player, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, and that's all you can ask for. I think, you know, that's something that we've had this discussion before here on the podcast about kids finding the right place for them and not getting so caught up in what level of basketball it is, because when you're in high school, you have a tendency to get caught up, and everybody thinks,
sure,
and parents think, and, you know, just with the AAU system the way it is today, you know, people think it's Division I or it's nothing. And if they don't get that scholarship offer, that their basketball career is over or it's been a waste. And we've talked to so many people, whether it's Division III coaches or NAIA coaches or players who have played at that level. And everybody just to a person talks about just how good the experience was if they ended up in the right place for them. And I think that's something that if we could get that message across to high school players and parents that, hey, anybody who wants you to come play for their college program, if they're recruiting you, if they're interested in you, you should be flattered by that. And
absolutely.
And then you should look and find what's going to be the best fit for me academically and athletically. And it sounds like you were able to get that. And I've known Coach Hunt for a long, long time and played against his son Casey, who was a year, Casey was a year younger than me. So I've known their family for a long, long time. And Coach Hunt's a great guy, and I'm sure I know that if you had an opportunity to, you know, spend your time there under him, that you can vouch for just what a good basketball mind he is, and then just what a good person he is as well.
He truly is. He was a guy, and I don't know. I think it's something I've always tried to emulate. Was I think he might have yelled twice in my time there, like really yelled. And one time was because I think guys took pillows from the hotel room and we got charged more like that. No, like not being the smartest, but he didn't yell. But guys played so hard for him. He just had this. He commanded this respect and this admiration they had for him that you just didn't want to disappoint him. And to me, as a coach, if I can get guys to do that, not out of fear and not worried that they're going to get yelled at or that they're going to have to run, I think you just get so much more out of people. And he had a way of doing that I'm still trying to figure out. But it was pretty impressive to see. And then if you played with Casey, I know Casey was came down a couple times and worked this out. And talk about guys that were skilled, man. I mean, he would put us through these drills and demonstrate them. And all the guards would look at each other like, we're supposed to do that? Like, how is he – and I actually played with his youngest son, Chad, who was just a stud, 6'6", 215, could shoot from 28 feet, dunk from the free throw line. You know, we showed up on the same day and said, hey, what position do you play? And he said, the two guard. I'm about 6'2", and I'm like, oh, man, I'm
Well, it's okay. Funny because so. I hadn't seen Chad in years and years and years. And when I was playing against Casey, Chad was just, you know, I mean, he was little. He was younger. I'm 49. Going on 50. So Chad was just a little kid back when I was, you know, when I was playing against Casey in high school and in college. And then I saw Casey. He's now working for the Charlotte Hornets. He's their director of youth basketball. So I went to a junior NBA conference. I've been there now 3 years, I think. But the first year I went and saw Chad there and hadn't seen him probably for, you know, 25 or 30 years. So it was nice to kind of reunite and see him. And again, good family and good basketball coaches all around. People that
for sure
a basketball family without questions.
The Head Start Basketball Holiday Camp for boys and girls in grades 1-6 will be held on December 26th and 27th. Join us for two fun days of basketball fundamentals, contests, and small-sided games. You can find more information or get registered at headstartbasketball.com.
Let's jump from playing to starting to think about coaching. Was coaching something that you knew you wanted to do from the time you were younger, or was it something that hit you in college? Did it hit you after you got done playing? You said, hey, I want to stay involved in the game. When did the idea of becoming a coach start to enter your mind?
I think it was always there. You know, both my parents were in the education field. My dad was a school psychologist. My mom's a special ed teacher. So kind of going into that education, coaching, it was just kind of a natural thought. I just figured that's, you know, it seems pretty easy. You get the summers off. I mean, little did I know, but you know, summers off, weekends off, you get to coach. How great is this? You don't have to do anything. So that was kind of always the thought that I had. And then, you know, being in college and working different basketball camps and doing stuff like that, I really just enjoy teaching the game. Things always just kind of made sense to me on the basketball court. I think maybe because I wasn't as naturally athletic as some of these guys or stuff, and I had to figure out, okay, how do I do this move? And it just kind of, like I said, it made sense to me. I was able to piece it together and then relay that message to other people and figure that stuff out. Coaching was something I always wanted to get into. I was able to, once I was done playing, I you know, got hurt and still had a little bit of school left, so I was finished school and was able to go volunteer at Willoughby South High School and coach there, and 23 years old and was ready to roll and thought I knew everything and was ready to take the world over and realized how little I did actually know about coaching. So
How long did it take you to realize you didn't know very much?
probably you know, I thought I knew basketball because, you know, we go to the open gym and I'm you know, killing guys because I'm a college guy and they're high school. I'm thinking, this is gonna be easy. This is fun.
Right.
And then I think the first time I had to talk to a parent or the first time we had to do something like a paperwork thing, and I'm like, wait, there's not just basketball. Like, we have to do – there's organization to it. Guys have to get locks. They have to get lockers. We have to do uniforms. We have to do transportation. That was the part that just kind of blew my mind, was all the logistical stuff outside of the game of basketball that really showed me I had no idea what I was doing.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I think that I've said before that when I think back to getting my first job – as a coach, so my first quote real coaching job beyond just, you know, working at camps and stuff while I was playing, was I was the JV coach at Bay when I was, I think it was my second year. First year out of school, I volunteered at Strongsville as an assistant JV coach, but I don't really count that because I was just kind of, you know, along for the ride. I'm just sort of standing on the side. And then I got my first real job. I was the JV head coach at Bay. And I remember the first time I went into practice and I'm standing there and the 12 kids are in front of me and we get started and I've got some, you know, some drills and stuff. And of course, you know, you think you know it all, but basically all I had was the things that I had learned from the coaches that I played for. You know what I mean? I had nothing else. It was like, all right, we're gonna run a practice just like Strongsville did and just like Kent State did. And that's it. That's all I got, fellas. And
that's what,
and so you're running that first drill. And I just remember being one set of eyes and just looking and going, oh my God, there was just 5,000 things that they did wrong in that first 5 minutes. How am I possibly ever going to fix and correct and do all these things? And just, I just remember that just being overwhelmed. And so I guess as it went on, I still felt like, I know what I'm doing and I'll figure it out and whatever. And now I look back on that and I'm like, I really wasn't a very good coach at that point. And slowly over time, I think you come to realize that, A, there's so much out there for you to know. No matter how much you know, there's always more that you can figure out and find out. So that's one piece of it. And then I think the other part of it, number two, is that you don't realize, especially as a young kid, you don't realize how much time other coaches are putting into everything that goes into building a great program and what it takes. And we can get into that in a little bit when we talk about your high school experience and just the amount of time that it takes to build, whether it's a college program or whether it's a high school program, the amount of time it takes to do that right, especially nowadays, is just, it's immense. And I don't think I realized that when I was younger.
No, that's the thing. You know, as a player, you go to practice, you do what you're asked to do, maybe stick around and get some shots up afterwards, and then you're gone, and, you know, you probably don't think about it the rest of the time. And then, as a coach, you spent hours planning that practice, you know, down to the details, and then afterwards, you spend hours just critiquing it and you know, thinking about everything that went right and went wrong, and I should have done this, and this kid did this, and should I have let him get away with that, or do I need to correct it, or I should have. You know, and it's just a never-ending process. I you know, my wife always used to laugh. Like, we'd stay after practice and as the coaching staff talk for, you know, an hour sometimes, and you just get lost in it.
Yep.
Like, you just did this. Like, why are you talking? Like, I'm just here for 2.5 hours. Why do you have to stay for another hour? And you just don't even realize it. But, you know, to do this or to do what, you know, any of us do or any of these guys have been on your podcast, and like, you have to be a little bit crazy. You have to be obsessed with it because, especially at the high school level or at the junior college level, none of us are in this for the money. I mean, it's just not the amount of, if you broke it down what you make hourly, it's pretty disgusting.
Yeah, it's pretty bleak. That's a number that no coach wants to see.
No, not at all.
And you especially don't want your wife to see it if you're married.
Oh God, no. I guess the other part, I didn't realize, you know, growing up, I just assumed, I don't know, coaches probably made a bunch of money. You guys in the NBA make, you know, a couple million, college coach, a couple hundred thousand. Like, I'm sure a high school coach does pretty well. And then you see it, and you're like, oh, man, that's okay. That's not exactly what I was thinking.
No, not at all. And I think that's one of the things, too, that as players and the parents of players, thinking about kids who are coming up from third grade on up through high school, I don't think people have an understanding of what the reality of the coaching profession is, because mostly what they see is what you just described. You see the NBA coach who has a $6 million salary. You see John Calipari at Kentucky who makes whatever he makes, $5 million a year. And you see, those are the big names that you see on TV. Those are the people that get talked about. But the real stories are the guys who are working and building great programs at the high school level who are, again, making peanuts. And then for the guys who are in college coaching, the vast, vast, vast majority, as I'm sure you can attest to, are guys who are working really, really hard, working tons and tons of hours, making very little money. And in some cases, people who are trying to break into the level above where they are now, in some cases, volunteering themselves and making not just little money, but no money.
Yeah.
And just to be able to get their foot in the door, to be able to get it started. And I don't think the general public really understands that piece of coaching because they only see the glamour coaches. They don't see how even on a Division One staff, when you have, you know, a staff of six or seven or eight guys, you know, you get down to guys seven or eight, and those guys aren't making any money, and they're working awfully hard at what they do. And I think it's a, you know, I'm sure you can attest to it. It's a difficult, it's a tough lifestyle, especially if you're not just a single person.
For sure. And that was a huge, you know, being at South and being, so I went from volunteering to the next year being hired to teach there, became the varsity assistant. And again, thought I was on top of the world. I think I was going to make like $3,000 for doing that. Man, this is great. But again, just getting married, having no kids, my wife's working, I'm working. She didn't care when I was gone. A kid would call me or text me and say, "Hey, it's Friday, it's 7:00. Can we get in the gym and do some work?" Sure. You know, it's Sunday morning. Can we get in the gym and do some work? Absolutely. And having all that free time was great. Now having still having a wife, for some reason, she's still with me, even though I spend all these hours away. And having a 5-year-old daughter and having other responsibilities, it does become, you have to be a little bit more precious with your time. So as you get older and you add these responsibilities, you know, my love of basketball isn't any different. I've just added other things that I really care about and love that. So you have to be smart with it and figure out how I'm going to be able to, you know, there's only so many hours in the day. So how can I give each of those appropriately?
Yeah, for sure. What you said earlier about sitting in the coach's office for an hour or two after practice was over or after a game completely resonated with me, because while I was at Richmond Heights, I think back to when we first started. So I got there, I think I was 25 my first year, and Phil Schmuck, who was the coach at that point, was
Schmuck, good guy, yeah.
Phil was like 32, and then Jason Pop was, he might have been 22 maybe at that point. And so we would literally, like, we'd have like a 3.5-hour practice, and then like I had nowhere to go, and Jason had nowhere to go, and Phil was just a junkie. So we'd sit in the coach's office literally after having just practiced for 3.5 hours, and we'd be in the coach's office for another hour and a half, where the game would end. You know, we'd have a game on Friday night, and it'd be midnight. We'd still be sitting in the coach's office just talking. You didn't think anything of it at that time, because as you said, you had no other responsibilities. And that's probably one of the thing that I miss the most about not being a high school coach, is those conversations in the locker room. Those can never be replaced. And in essence, I feel like this podcast is in a lot of ways replaced that post-game coach's office talk for me.
Yeah.
Because you just don't get that same ability to rehash everything and talk it through and just talk hoops with a bunch of guys who are as passionate about it as you are. So I could totally relate to that sentiment for sure.
No, it's amazing too with some of those conversations, how you can go from starting thinking you are the worst team in the world, and I don't know how we're ever going to win a game, to we're pretty good, back to we're the worst team in the world, and this kid is number one on your depth chart, to someone brings something up. It's just, like I said, in a matter of an hour, the way your opinion goes up and down, it changes and sways, and it's just, it is a special thing that you kind of have to be, like I said, a little bit crazy to do. But if you are and you have that gene in you, then there's nowhere else you'd rather be.
I agree. All right, talk a little bit about when you were an assistant. Talk about what you feel you learned as an assistant coach that eventually helped you when you took over a head job. And then B, give us some things that, through the course of your experience, things that you think make for a good assistant coach. So if any assistant coaches are out there listening, what are some things that good assistants in your mind do to help their program and help their head coach to succeed?
Yeah, I think, well, number one, having been in both roles, it's important to kind of know what your head coach expects of you and what your head coach wants. You know, I've been in spots where it's the head coach likes to do most of the coaching and talking and do all this stuff, and then I'll jump in and add something here or there. And I've been in other spots, you know, where I'm at now, where they say, "All right, hey, you got the defense. Let's go put the whole thing in and you're responsible for that." So I think at the high school level, I definitely learned just pick your spots. Be a counterbalance to your coach. If you have a coach that, you know, likes to, I guess, yell or get into people or do things like that, maybe be the guy that goes up to someone afterwards and say, "Hey, fine, you know, here's what he meant." Just kind of rephrase what the coach said. You have a coach that's a little bit more relaxed, maybe you could be the guy that's the stickler on the drill. You know, make sure everyone's foot hits the exact right spot. Make sure everyone's doing this part just right.
Because I think if you have the same voice coming from every coach in the staff, the exact same voice, it kind of tends to cancel each other out. So to have a little bit of that, you want to have the same message, but maybe a different way of communicating that message to the players. So I think that was the main one. As far as assistants go, you know, there is a huge difference, and I forgot this even in the couple years I did, but from the first seat to the second seat, there is a huge difference. As an assistant, you are focused on one, two, maybe three things, or a couple of players, or, hey, we want to get this play that I put in, or I scouted this one thing. As a head coach, you have an entire program that you're thinking about. And each decision you make, there are 50 other things going on into it, because you want to play this kid because he actually did really well on some tests in school and he's been working hard and he deserves it. But this kid shouldn't play because you heard from his parents that he did something. But, you know, you don't relay that to all the assistants. So you're just trying to – you have to remember that as an assistant, that you can offer the suggestion, you know, support it with you know, why you believe in that. But then at the end of the day, kind of just got to go along with what the head guy says, because no one writes articles in the paper about how the assistant coach made a mistake and should have ran this defense or should have called this player, shouldn't have played that guy. It kind of, at the end of the day, you get the responsibility as the head person. So it's just a different feeling.
Yeah, I think that's a huge, huge point that you just made, and I love it. And that is that, one, you make those suggestions, and I think that a good head coach makes their assistants feel valued in
For sure.
bringing those suggestions to them. But then ultimately, I think one of the key traits that I found as a longtime assistant coach was you have to learn very quickly not to take offense when your idea is ignored or shot down or just isn't put to use. Because I think, as you said, the head coach knows that the record is on their shoulders and the spotlight is on them, and whatever decision ultimately gets made is not going to reflect on the assistant coach. It's going to reflect on the head coach. And so I think that that's something that the good assistant coaches that I've been around and in my own experience, I just found that you have to be willing to give those suggestions and keep giving them. Even if 99 in a row they get rejected, it might be that 100th suggestion that you come up with that your head coach says, oh yeah, that is a good idea, let's do that. And maybe it helps the program or helps the team win. And you can't take offense to those other 99 times where your idea was dismissed. You just have to keep plugging away at it. And I think if you have a good relationship with your head coach, and conversely as the head coach, if you have a good relationship with your assistant, I think that really provides a quality staff, as you said, a balance, a point counterpoint where everybody has input, and yet there's still a clear hierarchy of who's making those decisions.
For sure. And it's a huge difference just in the fact that, you know, the relationships with the players. This, as an assistant, I can kind of be the nice guy to a certain extent. It is a nice role to be in, where if the kid comes up to me and says, well, why aren't I playing, or I should have done this, I'll explain it to them and tell them why they're not and things like that. But at the end of the day, I go, well, it's not my decision exactly. Like I can point to it, or you know, there's not as much responsibility. I don't know if it's the exact right word, but you don't have to. You have a little bit of deniability in it,
and right, sure.
You know, and that's the truth. I'm being honest. It just makes your life just a little bit easier. It's not quite as heavy on your shoulder. It's still heavy. You still care. You still want to win. You're giving everything you can, and you're not throwing your head coach under the bus. But it's just, like I said, something about that one chair. They're set up about 6 inches apart. But something about moving down that one chair changes everything.
I think it's a little easier to walk away from a loss as an assistant coach. And
absolutely.
And I think you described it well. I don't know if you can quantify that. I don't know if I can put that into words, but I just know that in situations, and even the levels that I've been a head coach at, you know, I was a JV head coach, and then I've coached my own kids and their, you know, rec and travel and AAU basketball. And
yeah.
And when I'm the head coach, I take those losses way harder than I do when I'm an assistant coach. Because as a head coach, you feel that responsibility for the performance of your team. When you're an assistant coach, there's some small piece of you that says, well, it's on the head coach.
For sure. No, completely. And I know, I'm sure Coach Bo, who's at Lakeland, will probably listen to this at some point. It's not, you know, this is nothing, but that is true, because you think, well, maybe, you know, I might have done this differently, or I might have done that differently. And that's nothing against, and I'm sure my assistants that were under me felt the exact same way. And it's not, you know, we're all in it together. We're all on the same staff, and we all have the same goal, and we're following it. But yeah, you see, there is just something where you can kind of say, all right, well, you're still upset and you still want to win, but there is just a different, it's not a sickening of a feeling. I actually talked to Matt Duffy, who's a football coach at South. He teaches next to me. We were talking. They have a big game on Friday to try and make the playoffs. And you know, we were talking about it, and I said, hey, when you win, are you excited? And he said, no, just kind of relieved. And I said, I know I'm the same way, but like, if you lose, you're sick, and if you win, you're just relieved. You're not even. But now, when you're a player, when you win, you're ecstatic, and when you lose, you go, we'll get the next one. Like, it's just, it's a crazy feeling when you switch role. Like, all the different roles that are part of a team take wins and losses just slightly different.
For sure, and I think that you as an individual, it becomes a challenge when the people around you don't have the same reaction to winning and losing, or the same style of reacting to winning and losing as you do. I know that was one of the things that, as a player, I would take losses really, really hard. And I oftentimes ask people, you know, do you love to win or do you hate to lose? And I always answer that question by saying, I hated to lose. I mean, I like to win. You might even say I love to win, but if you ask me which of those two emotions was stronger, I hated to lose. So the idea of losing a game and then getting on the bus and talking and giggling and laughing was completely foreign to me as a player. And so then when you have teams where the kids can do that, you're just like, whoa, that doesn't, I don't, do you guys care? And everybody, again, you have to remember, and it's something that I think you learn with experience, is that everybody's different. And I've often said that, you know, it's probably not healthy to have a bus full of kids that are crying and punching the seat in front of them after they lose. That's not a healthy way of going about dealing with a loss either. So everybody has their own way of doing it. But as a coach, you, I think, have to understand how different people react and how different people look at wins and losses. And like for me, like I said, I would describe myself as hating to lose. But I know there are people out there that have a different way of that manifests itself differently in different people.
For sure. And I think that's why, I think if you talk to most people that are heavily involved in basketball and are still doing it and aren't doing it, obviously, just because they're making millions of dollars, they're going to have that same philosophy of absolutely hating to lose. I don't think you get this far in the business in coaching by just going, you know, it's kind of fun. I hope we win. I hope you have to have that little switch that you cannot stand to lose, that you are. I have to wake up in the morning after a loss and be physically ill and just, why do I feel like, and it's a weird thing. Someone told me once, like, if your happiness is dependent on, you know, 16, 17 year old and 18 year old boys, like, you're in for a long, long life. It's very true. And I remind myself of that all the time. I still get very upset or become crazy because of it. So it's, I get what that person was saying and they were completely right, but it's still, it doesn't matter.
Right. It doesn't change that feeling of getting up the next day and just, and I guess
the first thing you think, right, like, I can't believe we lost last night. I can't, how did that happen? Yeah.
I remember more, and now this reference seems more dated than it ever has, but I remember as a player and then early in my coaching career, when you would lose, I didn't want to see the newspaper the next day. I did not want to get up.
You don't want to check the Twitter mentions nowadays.
Now I don't want to check social media. But at the time, I did not want to get up and see that we lost in the newspaper the next day. And, you know, even walking around school, both as a player and as a coach, you're just like, ugh, I don't even want to show my face after having lost that game last night. And it's just, again, I think if you're a competitive person and I think if it means something to you, then I think those are the reactions are completely normal for anyone who's competitive. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it's healthy, but I think it's normal. I definitely think it's a normal feeling.
No, like you said, going to school the next day, I used to just think, like, man, everyone is going to, this is going to be horrible. They're all looking. No one cared.
So true.
You know what I mean? It's looking back, like, no one, but I thought, man, everyone's looking at me. They're going to think that, you know, we lost because of me, or we did this, or I called the wrong thing, right?
no one, they're worried about their own thing. But to me, it was the most important thing. So it is kind of funny to see it like that.
Yeah, it was life and death early in, you know, especially for me as a player, and then early in my coaching career. I mean, I took that stuff super hard before you kind of learned how to deal with it and manage your emotions and figure it all out. And I think that you come to a healthier place where you're just as competitive, but you understand how to deal with it, because as you mentioned earlier, now you have a family, now you have kids, you have other things that you have to do in your life, and you have to be able to compartmentalize that to some degree so that you can continue to go forward and
for sure,
and be a productive person in other areas of your life. All right, so talk about your transition from being an assistant to getting your first opportunity to be a head coach at the high school level. Talk about first how that opportunity came to be, and then two, talk a little bit about what that transition was like to go from being an assistant coach and moving over that one chair like we described.
Yeah, I'd been at South for, I think, two or three years total, 1 year volunteering, two coaching, and I was 26, 27, and like I said, I knew everything at that time. I was ready to, you know, go win a couple state titles and then maybe move on to Duke and help out there or anything like that. I just needed an opportunity. So I'd actually interviewed at a couple different places when things came up, and was always told, you know, you're going to be really good. You just got to get some experience first. You got to get more experience. And, you know, the old classic, well, how do I get experience if no one's going to give it to me? So finally, Geneva High School, who was in our premier athletic conference at the time, had a job opening. And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to go talk to them, and was offered the job. And they had struggled. There was a time kind of in the early 2000s when they were pretty good. They had open enrollment. They were winning some district titles. And then in the previous years, I think the previous 3 years, they'd won, I think, five games total. But I just wanted my own program. I thought I had all the answers. I thought I knew everything. I was going to change the way people did this. So I took the job. I was still teaching at Willoughby South High School. I was getting my master's degree in coaching athletic administration. And my wife was pregnant. And I thought, you know what would be a good idea? To drive 45 minutes to Geneva every day after I to take over a program that won one game the year before. And you know, it was great. And, you know, just to show you how important it was, I think I was 2 weeks into the job. I'd already taken it. And the principal asked me, you know, how much is your contract? And I said, you know what? I never even asked. I don't know how much I'm getting paid. Which is funny now, kind of dumb on my part at the time. But I was willing to do whatever I had to do to get there. And just going there, I had every idea in the world. I'd read every book. I was ready to go. We were going to change the culture there. We were going to win. I remember, you know, the first day having the guys say, hey, we're going to practice cutting down nets. We're going to be cutting down nets this year when we win a championship, and we're going to be doing all this stuff. And I had everything like that. We won one game that year.
Did you cut down the net after that victory?
We should have. It was an away game with Kadiop. And looking back, we should have. And it was, I think it was like a 13th or 14th game. But I'll be honest, I think that might have been one of my favorite years ever coaching, possibly the best job I ever did. I mean, to be fair, we probably could have won three or four games, but it's not like I had like the 86 Celtics and we were blowing games. The kids played really hard. We you know, had developed kind of a culture and a program we wanted in the next year. By having those guys again, we were able to win nine games, which is the most they've won in a while. And I just think, you know, to me, I learned it's not about, okay, I have great quick hitters that I stole from these people, or I'm going to do this on defense or do that. It was about, you know, the long process of getting these guys in the gym and showing them how hard it is to win and how it doesn't just happen overnight. And you have to do all these little things. And like you said, changing the culture to, hey, we're happy that we lost by 10 to, no, that's not good enough. We have to do a little bit more. And in that 2 years that I was there and that process that happened was really, I learned a ton. It was, you know, our goal was to be in games and then to maybe beat some teams that we were supposed to beat and then to win some games maybe we weren't supposed to win and then to, you know, be considered when we stepped on the court with people, we were considered equals. And I think, you know, my record at that time, if you look at it, it's kind of put a dent in my career win-loss record. But some of the stuff I accomplished there will be stuff I remember kind of forever. So,
all right, so let me ask you this question, because I think this is something that a lot of coaches, especially young coaches, I think may struggle with. When you come into a program that has been a losing program, and you want to come in and you want to change the culture. And it obviously doesn't happen overnight. And you want to sell that culture building stuff. And that's easy to do in your first year when you're 0-0.
Yes. And everyone loved me then.
Right. That was great. And you come in, you're like, hey, I got all these great things. We're cutting down the nets. We're doing X, Y, and Z. This is the type of team we're going to be. And then all of a sudden it's January and you're 1-12. Yeah. So if you think back to that, like, do you have any advice for a coach who may be in that similar situation, who's trying to change the culture at a losing program and has great ideas, has a vision of what they want to do, but the challenge is that when you're not putting wins behind that vision, it becomes difficult to sell it to your kids, to the parents, to sure. administration, the greater community. So any advice for anybody who's in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, you really have to focus on the process. You know, and process-oriented is a coach term that everyone likes to use, but that has to be it. And you have to find other ways to measure success and measure growth. You know, we used to break down, hey, we're going to play for 3 minutes, and I'm going to call a timeout, and we're going to see what the score is. And we need to win these 3 minutes. You know, we would do that, and that would be a win for us, you know, and then we got to win the next 3 minutes. So find other little ways to get success, even if at the end of the day it's not. And then it's this fine line of, you know, we were going to be coming in there, and Geneva was notorious for, you know, Coach Ellis was a great coach, and they ran the Princeton offense, and they did all this stuff. And I thought, no, we're going fast. We want to play fast, and we want to do this, and we want to, and this is the only way we're doing it. And, you know, I was set on, you know, we're playing fast. This is it. We're going to teach these guys. And to be honest, I think there was the next year I realized there's probably a combination of both where we got to teach these guys how to play basketball. So there are times to play fast, and there's times where we have to come down and really execute and run a set, and there's no shot clock, and we're going to really, you know, negate this athleticism advantage or size advantage of the other team. So you have to be firm in your beliefs, but you also have to be willing to take an honest look in the mirror and realize, you know, okay, just because I thought this was the right thing and I've been planning for this for 2 or 3 years, it doesn't necessarily mean it fits in this exact situation. So it's tough, and you just have to be consistent. You can't have a message one day and it didn't work. It's like a free throw routine. Like, you can't have a free throw routine and then you miss 2 or 3 free throws in a row and go, that's it, I'm changing my free throw routine. And then you make 3 and you keep it, and you miss 2 or 3 and you change it again. You have to be consistent with it and kind of let it work over time.
I love that. I think it's key. And I know I've been guilty of that in the past, and not just in situations necessarily where we're losing, but I'll have something in mind, whether I see it, you know, I'll see something on YouTube, or I'll go to a clinic and I'll hear about it, or I'll read something in a book. I'll be like, oh yeah, I really want to institute that. I want to make that a part of my program. Or I'll see a new drill that tweaks something maybe I've already done. I'm like, yeah, that is something that I want to make sure I do. And I'll do it for a day, or I'll do it for 2 days, or I'll do it for a week. And then at some point I lose my focus, and that thing that was so exciting a week ago or 2 weeks ago has suddenly disappeared. And I think that's something that it's very challenging as a coach. And I think especially as you're a young coach and you're an inexperienced coach, to just chase that newest thing that you find. And
for sure,
as you said, the key is to think about what it is that you want to do from a culture standpoint. And you could maybe extend that to X's and O's to a certain degree. Obviously, good coaches are going to adapt whatever their core philosophy is X and O wise to their personnel and try to make that fit their personnel. But from a culture standpoint, the things that are going to be the pillars of your program, I think you really have to figure out what that looks like and then make a complete commitment to making sure that those things happen every single day, whether it's in the classroom, whether it's in on the practice floor, at the game, on the bus, out in public, wherever it is that you and your team are representative of your school. And that's sometimes, especially when you're losing, it's hard to do because,
absolutely,
you know, you look at it and you say, oh, you know, we just lost 5 in a row. We got to change something up and do something different. But I think you have to go back to where you were when you were 0-0 and say, okay, are the reasons why I wanted to do these things as part of my culture, are those reasons still valid? And if they're still valid, then you got to stick with them. And as you said, that's sometimes that's sometimes difficult to do. So I think that's a great piece of advice that you just shared there, Matt, for sure.
No, good. Yeah, no, absolutely. It is. Things look better when they're successful. You know, I've run some of the same stuff. Not everything, but you know, you have a couple of pet plays that you run, and man, they look really good now when I have college athletes running them, as opposed to when I, you know, our center was 5'10" at the most, you know, and worked his butt off, but you know, that backdoor lob play I put in for him wasn't great. You know, now that I have a 6'8" guy that can go to the top of the backboard to get it, it looks a lot better. So it's, you just have, you know, you have to know exactly who you're coaching and what you can get out of it. And it's, I really like your point too, of just being consistent with it and what are the main things that you're going to focus on. And I think, you know, as a young coach, sometimes you come in and you have, and we all have our notebooks of the clinics and we watch all the videos and we're ready to go and we have 10 million things. And then you just touch on one thing here and one thing here and one thing here and one thing. And you have to figure out what are your core values and what are your core things, you know, not only, you know, just culturally, but on the court, what are the things that, you know, everyone wants to be good at everything, but what are the things we're really going to focus on and we're going to be solid in these areas? And just every day you have to do that. And I think Brad Stevens, I saw spoke at a clinic in Cleveland. This is back when he was at Butler. No one knew who he was. He gave out a cell phone number. That shows you how long ago it was. And I tried it a couple years later. It was not still the same number. You know, he said the things that get measured get repeated, you know, and get like, so when you keep track of something, or every day you're doing a drill where you're measuring, those are the things that the kids know are important, and they're going to make sure that they, if you emphasize it, they're going to emphasize it too. So figure out, you know, to each coach what those things are that they really think these are our non-negotiables, that we are going to be good at these three or four things, and hopefully we're good at other stuff too. But these three or four things, we know no matter what, we're going to show up and we're going to be good at those.
Yeah, that focus is really, really important. We talked to John Baines, who's the head coach at Elmhurst College.
Okay.
Up near Chicago, and one of the things John said that he did is before the season, he would ask his assistants and his players to write down 10 things that they thought they needed to do this year to be successful. And then he would say, okay, now take away half of them. Okay, so now you're down to 5. He'd say, okay, now take away 3 more. All right, so now you're down to 2. And then he would collect those cards, and he would look at those 2 things and kind of take that as input for what are the most important things that our team needs to do or his team would need to do in that particular season to be successful. And not that he just, you know, took a poll and took whatever they did, but just kind of like what we talked about before, he's collecting information from people who are invested in the program. And then I think the greater point here as it relates to what we're talking about is he put a focus on 2 things. Like, these are the 2 things that all year long I think we need to do in order to be able to have a successful season. And so every day in practice, we're going to talk about these things. Every day pregame, we're going to talk about these things. When we have a team meeting, we're going to talk about these 2 things. And so the players are going to know over and over again, as you said, what gets measured gets repeated. And so the kids on his team, his coaches knew that these are the things that we need to do in order to have a successful season. As a result, he said it helped to keep him focused on what he was doing. And so I think that was something that, as a coach, I think that's a good activity that you could do with your team, especially if you're a high school coach beforehand, you know, before your season, and get an idea of what are some of the things that your team feels like they need to focus on. And then you can use that, their input, to kind of pare down what you feel is important. And then that can help you to keep that focus that we've been talking about.
Yeah, that's a phenomenal idea. I'm like everything else I've done in basketball, I'm stealing that.
As you've listened to the Hoopheads podcast, one common topic that continually comes up in our conversations is character. I'm fortunate to be associated with the Positive Coaching Alliance, a national nonprofit movement that provides valuable tools, training, and resources for coaches, athletes, parents, and administrators that is centered around sports and educational psychology and organizational behavior research. PCA combines this research with practical advice from a national advisory board of top pro and college athletes and coaches who utilize PCA principles at the highest levels of competition. Through a partnership with our local Cleveland chapter of the PCA, we are pleased to offer a discount code to allow you, our listeners, to take a PCA online course for just $20. To take advantage of this offer, visit the store on positivecoach.org and enter the discount code HOOPHEADS20. That's HOOPHEADS20 with 2 capital H's. Coaches, I hope you'll take advantage of this great offer from the Positive Coaching Alliance and help us continue to grow the game.
One of the other things, just speaking of that, I did early on that maybe another, it was an interesting thing for me, and I stole it from somebody else, but gave out note cards to guys and said, okay, I need you to put down, and we're not putting names on it, we're going to collect them as we ran it. I want you to put down how many minutes a game you think you should play and how many shots a game you think you should get. Just on a blank note card, we collected them and I added them up. And to no one's surprise, games would have had to have been like 200 to get there, and we would have had to take like 500 and some shots a game.
Right.
But it's just kind of an interesting exercise for guys to see, like, oh, okay, you're right. There's not everyone's going to get 12 to 15 shots a game. Like, it's just not going to happen. Not everyone's going to play, you know, 20 minutes or 25 minutes a game. So it's just, like you said, you let the players, you empower them a little bit to, hey, I'm interested in your opinion. What do you think? But then it also kind of shows them the reality of there's only so many shots and only so many minutes to go around. So, you know, you have to really earn them.
Yeah, I think anything that you can do where you're soliciting input from people who are stakeholders in your team, whether that's players or assistant coaches, I think that you end up, especially if you built a culture of trust and honesty, where people feel like they can share things and be honest and without fear of there being repercussions, or just, you know, again, if you've built a good relationship with the people who are part of your program, then when you do something like those two activities that we just described, you're going to get honest feedback that can help make you a better coach and help dial in your focus on what it is that you need to do, and then also gives you kind of a window into the way that your team thinks and the way your individual kids are thinking. And that can also give you some guidance as far as, okay, this kid thinks he's going to get 25 shots a game.
Yeah.
I got to start having these conversations to bring him down so he understands that he's an important part of the team, but I need him to defend and rebound, and he might get 4 shots a game, and I got to get him to accept that role. And you might not understand that fully until you go through a week or two of practice, and by then, now the kid's already disgruntled because you haven't recognized it early enough. So I think getting that information as early as possible is a great tool for coaches to be able to help their team be successful over the course of a season.
For sure. Yeah, the more, as you said, stakeholders, the more input those players and coaches feel like they have, I think the more they'll buy in. We use Coach K's philosophy, which she used with the gold medal teams that he won, was, you know, he doesn't have rules, he has standards, and he lets the players come up with the standards. Now, you know, I'll put them in the locker room and say, hey, let's come up with it. What's important to you guys? And obviously I'll kind of guide and shape those to make sure they fit. But I think if the players come up with it, and they do a pretty good job of it for the most part, they feel a little bit more important, you know, a little bit more importance to buy into it and really enforce it. And we leave them up in the locker room, and they really kind of, hey, that was my rule. I got to make sure that this happens. That was my standard. I have to make sure that they do this. And it's good. And they can kind of have some, you know, we'll tell them, you know, if this doesn't get uncomfortable in here a little bit, then nothing was accomplished. Because if you just stay in your comfort zone and no one wants to speak out or say anything, then nothing's going to change. So have those kind of awkward conversations now. And then when we step on the court and we're in between the lines, you know, we're all together. But now's the time to have those and figure out what we need to do to be successful. And if they have a say in it, and it's not just me going, here's my rules and this is how we do stuff, I feel like they really tend to buy in a little bit more.
Yeah, that buy-in is key. I don't think there's any doubt about that. When the days of the dictator on high coach just pontificating from up on a hill down towards the players, I think those days are pretty much over, and for good reason. And I think you said it right off the top when you talked about Coach Hunt and how he did things. And, you know, you don't have to yell and scream to get results. You can coach by having respect for the players, and you can coach by explaining and by coaching positively. And I think that's something that, not that it wasn't around, because there were plenty of coaches who coached positively 20 or 30 years ago, but there certainly is a lot more people who are coming from that philosophy today, just as we learn more and more about it from a scientific standpoint and more research is done about just how getting people to do things out of fear is not the best way to coax out the best performance out of a player. And so it's good to see that as coaches, just as a profession in general, that we've started to trend towards positive coaching, and we've left that days of the dictatorial coach behind us. All right, let's jump to your next job at Kenston, where you had a program that maybe had a little bit more of a winning tradition when you got there. So talk a little bit about how the opportunity to go to Kenston presented itself, and then just spend a few minutes talking about your experience there.
For sure. So yeah, that was, you know, 2 years at Geneva, had a nice year the second year. The Kenston job opened up, and Coach Jakacki had left and was going to Crestwood. So I went out and talked to those guys and was offered the job and knew that they had had a ton of success in the years past. They had been in the Chagrin Valley Conference. They were one of the bigger schools in that conference, and Coach Jakacki did an awesome job. I think they'd won 5 or 6 conference championships in a row and you know, would consistently win 18 or 19 games a year and were really rolling. And then me being the genius I am took over when they went from being the biggest school in the conference to the second smallest school in the conference, and going from Division II to Division I. But it was an opportunity, I think, to, you know, I would be at Geneva and I'd love my time there and it was great, but I would watch these, you know, Garfield Heights play and St. Ignatius and Menor and all these guys and think, you know, I want to compete at the highest level possible with these guys. I want to go and walk into these gyms and know I have a legitimate chance to go and beat these teams, you know, consistently. So Kenson gave me that opportunity. Phenomenal program. And as you said, I took over a program that had a culture in place and had, you know, success and winning. And it was a completely different situation because I, again, you know, now I'm 2 years in, so I definitely know what I'm doing. I know everything in coaching for sure now. I thought I did before, but now I really do. But just going over there and you know, Josh Keck and I are friends and we know each other and I respect everything he did. And he did almost everything that I would do the same way, but there were certain things I would do slightly differently. And you would hear, well, you know, Coach Jakacki did it this way, or we used to do it this way, or you know, this thing, we did this and this thing. So it was a whole different, kind of beast to slay, because at Geneva it was a little bit easy because I could say, well, that didn't work. You guys weren't winning when you did.
Exactly.
And now I'd say, well, you know, I get it, but and they're like, well, we won 18 games last year. Why would we change it? And you know, there was a point to all that. So it was again, not something I really thought of until I was put in the situation. Again, luckily, most of our philosophies were pretty similar, and there weren't anything super crazy drastic that we changed. But it was a really interesting experience to go from no one expecting you to win to we lost our first game that year to Warrensville Heights. They had, I think, a kid that went to Kent State, Harrell, and another kid that was a D2 point guard, and we lost in the last second. And just the gym was packed, and it was awesome. And I was like, this is everything I want. And then we lost, and just, you know, I had not felt a feeling like that in a long time. So it just kind of, you know, made me realize, hey, this is what you asked for. This is where you want to be. Yeah, people care now if you lose. It's a big deal. Like, being close in the games, it's not quite the same. So it kind of lit that fire under me again to really make sure that we, you know, just put a product out on the court that the community can be proud of, because they were out for everything, and it was great. And we ended up having a pretty good year. I think we won 15 or 16 games that year. Made it to the district semis, and again, just had a nice 3-year run there where we competed against some of the best teams. You know, we're playing St. Ignatius every year, and we're coming out of the wire. We're playing in we're up against Garfield, you know, with 2 minutes left in the district semifinal game to go to the district finals. And, you know, it was all the situations that I wanted to be in and was really excited about it, and had some really nice players there, some good guys, and it was amazing to see, you know, what a winning tradition can be and how you can kind of continue that.
Do you think the biggest challenge there was just the comparisons to the previous regime that you already described, or was there another challenge that sort of came to pass that you felt was bigger?
Yeah, I think the comparisons for a while were there, and then people started to realize, you know, this is a different, you know, beast that we're going against. But, you know, the thing that, and again, I'm just stealing stuff from people, but high expectations beat the alternative, which is, you know, like I said, I was, that's what I wanted. I went from having no expectations at Geneva to high expectations, and we need to meet these. And it was a challenge, and it was kind of a wake up call as to the different levels of and the X's and O's of the game were no different. You know, we did
same things and were successful with it. But just kind of the outside pressures there were a whole other level. And I really grew to embrace them and like them and you know, would take that challenge again any day. So I really enjoyed my time there.
All right. Talk about the transition then from high school to college, and start with the why you made the transition, and then we'll get into the nuts and bolts of how it's different and what you're doing in your role there at Lakeland now.
So that was a really hard decision. I was 3 years at Kenston, had finally gotten to the point where I was really kind of comfortable with that, how everything was going to roll and the operations day to day, and hey, we're going to do this camp at this point, we're going to do this thing at this point, and didn't really have to worry about that stuff, and had guys into the culture, this is our system and this is what we're doing. But the opportunity to go to Lakeland came up, and it scared me. It honestly made me a little bit nervous, and it was something that, you know, we talked earlier, this coming on here scared me a little, just because it was something a little bit different. And I think you need to, as I said earlier, you need to go outside of your comfort zone every once in a while, and you need to be scared. You need to kind of leap and take a chance and bet on yourself and your abilities to coach. And I didn't know how many opportunities I would have. I still teach at Willoughby South, so driving out to Kenston every day was getting to be a lot. But this was the one kind of opportunity I had to coach at the college level and still be a teacher. Obviously, as a teacher, we're not raking any crazy money, but I do very, I do well for what I need. And I can't, at this point, with a wife and a child, I can't go be, a grad assistant somewhere or, the video coordinator somewhere and make $10,000 at this point. I wish I would have done that when I was 22 or 23 years old, and those guys are doing it the right way if they are, but that's not an option for me anymore. So how am I going to get my foot in the door into the college game while still maintaining being able to teach? And then going to Lakeland gave me that opportunity. I did not know a whole lot about junior college basketball. Still kind of learning that, but again, it was an opportunity to see and to challenge myself. It was the same thing as playing in college. Like, am I good enough to do this? And at the end of it, when I did it, I went, yeah, you know what? You were good enough to do it. And it was the same thing with coaching. Like, am I good enough coach to do this at the college level? And jury's still out, I guess, but I feel like we've been pretty successful so far. So yeah, I think I definitely can. So that was kind of, it was a hard decision. It was scary, but it's definitely one that I'm happy that I made.
So what was it about the college job or the college opportunity that intrigued you to want to leave the high school level? What was it about college basketball and getting an opportunity to coach at that level that intrigued you?
I think part of it was just the focus on basketball more so than everything else. And I loved running a program and having my fingerprints on all kinds of different things and responsibilities with that. But it's a lot. It was nice to just to coach and compete with guys at, a higher level. And see where it's just, hey, this is basketball. And at the public school level, we were, I think at Kenston, we were the fifth or sixth smallest Division I school in the state as far as boys basketball happened. And we had some really nice teams. We would consistently win 15 or 16 games a year and go into the tournament and everything like that. But at a certain point, you're running into guys that just have more, as we say, they just have more dudes than you do. Right. And you can play as well as you can, but, everyone does it at the college level. That's on you a little bit. How hard are you going to go out and recruit? What kind of guys are you going to get? Are you going to put the time in? Are you going to put the effort in? Are you going to watch the film, make the calls? Are you going to get guys? So at the end of the day, you say, man, we don't have enough players. That's on us. So I like that, having that responsibility and saying if I work hard enough and I do this, then I can give myself the best chance to go into any game and win.
What's been the most surprising thing about coaching in college that maybe you didn't realize? Obviously, you had some experience as a college player, but being on the playing side and being on the coaching side, two totally different things. So is there anything about coaching at the college level that maybe you didn't realize or you didn't think about prior to jumping into that job?
Yeah, especially at the junior college level. Ours, playing Division III and then obviously watching Division I basketball and knowing some stuff about Division II and stuff. But the junior college level, just how many guys, and this is at every level, want the opportunity to play basketball, and how many really good basketball players there are out there. I remember, you know, last year getting my email set up at the school, of getting my first email from a prospective recruit. And, you know, this kid wants to come play. And I emailed him back. And then I got the next one and the next one and the next one. And I thought, I'm going to be the guy that emails everyone back. If someone emails me, if they take the time to do it, I'm going to email them back. To this day, I get 10 or 12 a day from guys all over the world. You can't get enough to. And I don't know how they even know about Lakeland or things like that, but the amount of people that want to play college basketball and want an opportunity is just, it's mind-blowing to me. And then at the junior college level, just how dedicated some of these guys are and what they're willing to do to have this opportunity. We obviously have been talking basketball for I don't even know how long, it seems like 10 minutes. So we all love the game of basketball. What these guys are willing to do to go through and how hard some of their lives are just to still be able to play basketball, I don't know if I love the game that much. I mean, we have guys that moved from Florida. A couple of them are nervous because they saw a snowflake on their iPhone luggage coming this weekend. They've never seen snow before.
That's awesome.
It's kind of – and then, you know, guys living in a hotel for a couple of weeks until they can find a place. And you know, there's four to a one-bedroom. And you know, because Lakeland's a Division II JUCO school, so we can provide athletic scholarships, but we cannot do room and board. So those guys are kind of on their own for that, and it's tough. And I was 18 years old to move from – if I moved from here down to Florida on my own to go do that, I don't know if I would have been able to handle it. But these guys find a way to make it work. So I guess that's been kind of the biggest shock for me was, you know, I thought I had a rough in college. Lake Erie had four or five buildings. My dorm was a one-minute walk from all my classes and a two-minute walk from the gym, and I thought, man, this is tough. So it's amazing to me how dedicated these guys are. So that was kind of the big shock.
All right, so give us the day-to-day rundown of kind of what your responsibilities are as an assistant there. What are some of the parts of the job that – let's focus on the things that you really like about what you get to do on a day-to-day basis.
For sure. So we have a staff of there's two paid coaches. There's the head coach, Coach Bo, who's been there for about 18 to 20 years, had a lot of success there. Myself, who's in my second year, and then Coach Hunter joined our staff this year. He was from Shawnee State. So all three of us have full-time jobs outside of this. I think that's probably the biggest difference in the JUCO level or some of these smaller schools is that this isn't our full-time position. I teach, you know, seven special ed classes a day, and then go and do this. But we still have the same expectations as most four-year universities, where they have two or three full-time coaches. So my job will be, I'll do a lot of the film breakdown. We have a game coming up on Saturday, so I'm in charge of that scouting report. We're getting as much as I can. I'm the guy that's in charge of the weight room. I will work with the guards. I'm in charge of the defense this year. I am the go-between for the academic liaison, since I'm a teacher as well, so we're worried about the academic part with these guys. So there's a lot of responsibilities. I basically have – I'm a associate head coach and a GA all rolled into one. So get all the good stuff and some of the bad stuff as well too. So this junior college level is amazing in that it is – some high-level college basketball, but then there's also some things where you just don't have the resources of some of these other guys, so it's you're spread a little thin.
So you're like the MacGyver of college basketball is what you're saying.
Essentially, some of these places it's got. I mean, I drove driving a minivan with some guys in it. I think I get to drive a conversion van in a couple weeks, so that'll be the first time I get to do that. But then there's also times where we take first-class buses and we're going to these nice places. We practiced at Hinkle Fieldhouse last year on our way to the national tournament.
Nice.
There's some really cool experiences that you had, and then there's some ones where you go like, man, why this is college, and then there's other times you go, man, I can't believe I get to do this. So it's been a myriad of experiences this last year, so I've really enjoyed it.
So ultimately, as you look at kind of where you're headed with your coaching career, what do you see in the future for yourself? Like, what ultimately – you know, you've mentioned about being a teacher and the challenges of, you know, trying to keep your teaching job and provide for your family, and then the ambitions that you have on the coaching side. So ultimately, as you see, you look, you know, a few years out, have you kind of thought about where you see your basketball coaching career headed next, or are you just singularly focused on what you're doing now at Lakeland?
I knew you were going to ask me this. Dang it. No, I've actually, no, this is the first time someone asked me a couple of weeks ago, you know, what's your 3-year plan or your 5-year plan? For the first time in my life, I don't really have one. I don't have that. I guess ideally, I really enjoy teaching. It's something I don't mind getting up in the morning and going to school. I love dealing with my students. But if I could be paid well enough to coach basketball full time, it's something that I would love to do. So I guess my ultimate goal with this would be, you know, to maybe skip a few steps in the coaching ladder by getting in here and maybe at some point becoming a head coach at this level. And then I know there's been guys that have had success at this level, and you can kind of skip that, you know, fourth assistant, third assistant, and maybe move up somewhere where you can make a healthy living being an assistant coach at it, you know, and make it a full-time position. That would be, I think that's kind of my ultimate goal. But said, part of me is just do the best job you can, and things will work out how they should.
Yeah, I think that's a piece of advice that I think the first time we got that on the podcast was from Coach Showalter from USA Basketball, and he went through kind of a story of himself and being a young guy and being at camp and just making sure that he was always doing the best that he possibly could, whether he was working with a high-level player or whether he was working with a third grader. And ultimately, the point of his story was you're never going to get the next opportunity if you don't do the best job you possibly can at the place where you are right now. So make where you are the most important place there is. And sure, if you do that, then more opportunities are going to present themselves. So I think that's the right philosophy to take. And I think if you have kind of at least an idea of where you want to go, and then you focus on the here and now and you do the best job that you possibly can, then I think opportunities for all coaches out there, you know, if you're doing what you're supposed to do in the place where you are and you have aspirations of going somewhere else or moving up, that those things kind of take care of themselves if you're doing a great job in the place where you are. We're coming up close to about an hour and 25 minutes here, Matt. So I want to wrap up by giving you a chance to share your contact information, how people can reach out to you after they've heard the podcast, if they just want to reach out and say thanks or maybe talk some hoops with you. Let people know how they can find you. And then after you do that, if there's anything that we didn't touch on tonight, one final parting shot that you may have, you can go ahead and share that, and then we'll jump back in and wrap up the episode.
For sure. Well, that right there, that part where you followed up what I said with what Coach Showalter said, is what made me nervous about coming on here. There's no way I could follow up a guy like that. I mean, he's much better than I did. But no, this is why it's such an awesome opportunity, you know, to be on here. My contact information, we're on the Lakeland Lakers Athletics website. My email's on there. My phone number's on there. If anyone has any questions or would like to get a hold of me somehow, it's definitely on there. I have a Twitter. I think it's Coach Matt Vespa. I don't tweet a whole lot. I mostly just steal stuff from other people. But feel free to give that a follow if anyone wants to. And just as far as this goes, this is the great part about basketball, is that, you know, there are so many really smart people out there, and you can take stuff and have the same philosophies as people, or just find a way that they teach something just slightly better or have a different terminology for it. And, you know, we talked about the differences in the game now and maybe in years past, and this is definitely one of the good parts of it, is that there is so much information out there now for people, and there's so much access to all this stuff. There's no reason that coaches should be getting better and players should be getting better and taking advantage of it and sharing. Hearing guys talk, they said basketball is one of the biggest thieving sports in the world. No one comes up with anything new anymore. You just take something from somebody else and you know, make it fit what you have. And that's something I actually like about it. So I think what you guys are doing is phenomenal. You are sharing the game at a high level and not just kind of going through the basics of, hey, our team's going to play hard and we're going to try and do this. You guys know what you're talking about. You're putting people out there that really know what they're talking about. So personally, as a listener and someone that really loves the game, I appreciate what you guys do and the opportunity for me to be on here and somehow get on this podcast with the same people that you've had on is a great honor for me. So thank you.
Well, we appreciate that. Appreciate the kind words. It's always good to know that there are people out there that are listening and finding value in what, you know, what we do. And we appreciate you being willing to take an hour and a half out of your time to jump on with us and share. And that's one of the things that, just for me to piggyback off your final point there, what we found, and, you know, I guess I sort of knew this in the back of my head, but the podcast has really brought it home for me, is the fact that the coaching profession, people are so willing to share and want to reach back and help people who are coming up behind them or people who are out in front of them with ideas and thoughts and just share what they know. And that's something that's been not a complete revelation to me because I think I understood it, but the podcast has made it go from an abstract concept to a concrete concept that people are willing to share. And if you're a coach out there, whether it's the Hoopheads podcast or it's another podcast, of which there are a lot of great ones out there for coaches, whether it's going to a clinic or reading a book, there's always ways, as you said, to grow and improve your craft. And I think that's really what has impressed me about all our guests and the people that we've been fortunate enough to interact with as our audience. So we're thankful that people are out there listening. And as I said, we can't thank you enough for being a part of it. We're excited to have you a part of the Hoopheads Nation family. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have 4 different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.